You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, does quantum mechanics arise due to repulsive forces between many interacting classical parallel worlds?
You get this repulsive force which prevents them from actually getting too close. And that sets up ripples, you know, which propagate through all of these sets of parallel worlds.
Redefining life based on our ability to predict the future.
But biology can't afford to wait long times. Or in other words, if I could figure out with a very high accuracy that tiger over there is going to eat me, but it would take me a very long time to figure that out, then that tiger over there would eat me.
And a quantum identity crisis, deriving the symmetrization postulate of quantum theory from the assumption that electrons are indistinguishable.
When I first encountered it as an undergraduate, I just couldn't follow the argument. I just didn't believe it, frankly.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. So, Brendan, what have you been doing since the last podcast?
Well, I had been hoping to take a bit of a break. This podcast has turned me into such a physics celebrity, and the attention from all the fans, though much appreciated, thank you very much, it's just been wearing me down.
Oh no, so what happened?
Well, I found this nice quiet comet to visit for my vacation. It's called 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. It got fantastic reviews on TripAdvisor. So I went off, and I was just settling down, taking a nap. And then I heard this noise.
What was that?
The European Space Agency had sent the Philae spacecraft to land on my comet as part of the Rosetta mission to collect data and transmit it back to Earth. I hate the space paparazzi. Why would they leave me alone?
Brendan, is any of that actually true?
Well, okay, I really only hung out in the backyard, but it's been pretty cold out there. I just sometimes feel the pressure to make each podcast more exciting than the previous one. And I never get to do any on-location reporting. But that really was the sound of the spacecraft landing on the comet after its 10-year trip in space. Thank you to the European Space Agency for the audio footage. Sensors in Philae's feet recorded the sound of touchdown as it first came into contact with the comet in the form of vibrations detected in the soles of the lander's feet. The landing itself is, of course, an incredible achievement, and we congratulate everyone involved in the mission.
Data from the touchdown show that Philae's feet first penetrated a soft surface layer on the comet several centimeters thick that's probably, or possibly, a dust layer, and then they hit a hard surface, probably an ice dust layer. Since then, mission scientists have reported signs of organic molecules on the comet. That's exciting because there's speculation that the building blocks for life on Earth could have been brought to our planet by a comet.
And just to reiterate, those organic molecules were not left behind by me on my vacation to the comet.
On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll also find links to the 3D map of the comet built from data that Philae returned.
At the time of recording, Philae is sleeping and its ultimate fate is unknown. We'll no doubt be hearing more about this mission in FQXI's next podcast when we have our annual roundup of physics stories of the year. Though that's just a guess on my part, not a spoiler.
In the meantime, our first item is both closer to home and about as distant from Earth as it can possibly be, since it encompasses the effects of interacting parallel universes on lab experiments that physicists carry out every day. This is a new theory proposed by physicist Howard Wiseman of Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia, and colleagues. They have shown that many of the weird and wonderful quantum effects that we measure, the uncertainty and the general fuzziness of the quantum realm, could arise from the repulsive forces between many interacting classical universes.
On the podcast, we've often talked about the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics, set up by Hugh Everett, in which quantum processes create multiple parallel universes. This is a totally different idea, however. In Wiseman's setup, the contents of each parallel world are governed only by classical physics, Newton's laws of motion, and other straightforward, non-spooky laws.
Earlier, I spoke with Wiseman, who explained to me how nearby classical universes could interact in such a way that they would manifest various quantum phenomena in our experiments.
So our theory we call the many interacting worlds approach to quantum mechanics. So the worlds are just like you learn about in high school, with particles moving, with forces on those particles. But that would just be classical. We know the world's not classical. So what we postulate is that there are a huge number of parallel worlds. Some of them are going to be completely different from our worlds. Others of them are going to be almost the same, you know, down to just a microscopically different position of a single particle, say. And what we're postulating is an interaction between those parallel worlds, which only takes place when they are extremely similar. And what we've shown, or at least plausibly argued, is that you can come up with an interaction which will give you all of quantum mechanics out of this interaction between essentially classical worlds.
Where do these classical worlds come from? Why are there these multiple classical worlds?
So why are they?
Maybe I could ask you why there's any world at all, I suppose. It's a deep philosophical question. But
This is our first paper on the topic. We aren't at the stage, therefore, of addressing questions like, you know, the origins of the universe, or where these worlds come from, or why they had the initial conditions that they did. But all we can say is that if you postulate the existence of these worlds, then you can reproduce quantum phenomena without having any of the hard-to-understand weirdness of quantum mechanics.
And so in your paper, you kind of run through a checklist of some of these weird quantum phenomena that you can begin to try to understand using this formulation. So perhaps we could sort of run through them now. So, you know, to begin with, I guess, you know, one of the things about quantum experiments, you know, it's quite famous, this idea that you can't predict the outcome of an experiment. You can only predict the probability of getting a certain outcome. So, you know, how would we think about that in this picture of yours?
So in our interpretation, we postulate this very large but finite number of worlds. And initially you just say, well, I don't know which world I'm in. So I'm equally likely to be in any one of those worlds. Now, of course, when you open your eyes and look around you, you can see all sorts of things about the actual world, and that will narrow down the possible worlds you'll be in. Okay? So the essential idea is that probability is just about your lack of knowledge about which of these interacting many parallel worlds you are actually in. Now, you say, well, okay, but if I do an experiment, I could find out something about that microscopic details, and that's true. And then what will happen at that point, it's like if you can sort of imagine a wide freeway going along with cars going in parallel, driving down the freeway. And the drivers in those cars had their eyes closed. So it's just running on some autopilot GPS type thing, say. So the drivers in those cars don't know which of those parallel worlds they're on. But then if it comes to a split in the freeway, say there's an off-ramp and the two left lanes have to go off or something like that, then, you know, if you were in one of those cars in the left lane, then you'll find yourself going off the freeway and ending up somewhere else, and then your GPS will tell you, hey, you're no longer on the freeway. So that's how we can explain probability in our theory. But there's nothing actually probabilistic about the way the worlds evolve. It's just your lack of knowledge about which world you're on to begin with.
Okay, so let's talk about quantum tunneling. So this case where quantum particles can kind of surmount barriers that they shouldn't classically have enough energy to kind of climb over. Sort of like, you know, me popping out on the other side of a wall suddenly, even though there shouldn't be any way that I was able to do that. So how does, you know, thinking about interacting classical worlds help explain tunneling?
Yeah, that's a really nice example which my co-author Michael Hall, who's also at Griffith University, came up with. So in our theory, when we say a quantum particle is going towards a barrier, that really means that, you know, we have all these parallel worlds, so there are you know, in each of those worlds, there is a particle going towards that barrier. But, you know, in each world, the particle has a slightly different position. Now, because of the interaction between the worlds, which we describe by this very particular inter-world force field, it's a repulsive type interaction, okay? So that's very important. It prevents worlds from ever becoming the same, because if they get closer, then this interaction actually pushes them apart. This repulsion means that a world which is closer to the barrier gets pushed towards it, and one which is further away from the barrier gets pushed slightly backwards in the other direction, so that the one in a world where it's closest to the barrier is actually going faster than the average, and it can have enough energy to get through the barrier.
You said something very interesting there when you started to talk about this kind of repulsive force between the interacting worlds and how, I guess, you don't want them to kind of collapse into being the same world. They have to kind of maintain some kind of separate identity.
Yeah, so that's what's novel about our theory, is you actually wrote down a potential energy, which gives you a force, which depends on the distances between nearby worlds. So we were guided by previously existing equations to write down that potential energy term, because obviously we know that quantum effects are real, so we want to be able to reproduce them. So we came up with a toy model where we said, okay, what's the simplest potential energy term we can write down, or the simplest force we can write down, and what we know we sort of need to get quantum mechanical predictions in the end. And so what's unusual about our interaction, you know, which is why it makes sense to talk about these as parallel worlds that almost don't interact, is that there is no interaction between them unless every single particle in one universe is very close to every single particle in the other universe.
Can this explain why it is that we only see quantum phenomena on very small scales, rather than me popping through a wall or existing in two places at the same time or something like that?
If I just give an intuitive answer to your question, if you imagine trying to do an experiment where you want to see whether you can, you know, tunnel through a wall or not, in a sense, it's a whole lot of particles which have to be exactly the same in every world in order to see an effect like that. And that's just an experiment which is much, much harder to do.
So another famous feature of quantum mechanics is that, you know, there's this kind of duality between waves and particles. So, you know, light can exhibit behavior like a particle, it can act like a wave. And one experiment that really highlights this is the double slit experiment. So I think this is something that you've looked into in quite a lot of detail. So can you explain to us what the double slit experiment is, and then how you can explain that using this model of interacting classical worlds?
So the double slit experiment is where you have a quantum particle going towards a screen, and there are two slits in that screen. And, well, ordinarily, if it's a particle, if we were just talking classical physics, if you see it on the other side of the screen, then it must have gone through, you know, either the top slit or the bottom slit. In quantum mechanics, we can do an experiment, so this is a famous interference experiment using this double slit, where let's say we block off the bottom slit and just look at what happens with the particle in the top slit. Well, then what you see, if the particle gets through, is the particle turns up at an apparently random place on the screen. And it's not a very interesting pattern, it's just this broad blob. But if I have both slits open at the same time and send my quantum particle towards that, then I get what's called an interference pattern. And so basically you get the stripes appearing, which are called interference fringes. Okay, so how do you explain this? If you think of the particle as going through either the top slit or the bottom slit, so how does the particle know when it goes through the bottom slit whether the top slit is open or not? Okay, because if the top slit is open, then it should go, you know, it's somewhere which gives you this interesting pattern. Whereas if the top slit is closed, then you just get this boring pattern. So in standard quantum mechanics, the answer is actually there is no particle, or at least there's no particle position. What we have is just a wave. And the wave, because it's a wave, it can go through two slits at the same time. Only at that final screen does the position of the particle appear when it's actually measured. So this is what standard quantum mechanics says. So our interpretation, of course, you can ask about particles and where they go, and what we say is that in any individual world, the particle will go through either the top slit or the bottom slit, and it will follow some path towards the final screen, and where it ends up is where you'll see it. So then, you know, how do you explain this interference phenomenon? Well, it's very simple, because a particle going through the lower slit can tell whether the upper slit is open or not, because in nearby parallel worlds, there are particles going through the upper slit, if it's open, whereas if it's closed, there won't be any. So what happens as you go past the slits and towards the screen is that the different parallel worlds will, they spread out and they can get close together. You get this repulsive force which prevents them from actually getting too close. And that sets up ripples, you know, which propagate through all of these sets of parallel worlds. And what we've shown by some detailed numerical simulations, which were done by Dirk Deckert, who's third co-author on the paper, is that we can get patterns that look essentially the same as the patterns predicted by quantum mechanics. So we did the simulations with 41 worlds, I believe. I mean, if you just glance at it, you'd say, oh, these two pictures look the same. If you look closely, you can see small differences. But what we think is that, you know, as you increase the number of worlds bigger and bigger, that those differences would get less and less.
So let's talk about, you know, another thing that everybody thinks of when they think of quantum mechanics, and that is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Okay, so maybe I should say what Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is. It says that you can't prepare a quantum particle so that you can know exactly what its position will be, if you measure that, and exactly what its momentum, which is essentially its velocity, is if you were to measure that instead. Now, in our interpretation, in any one world, a particle does have a definite position and velocity. Because our worlds are essentially classical, so Heisenberg's uncertainty principle just does not apply to our world. But if we know with very great accuracy what the position of the particle is, that's essentially saying that we are narrowing down the possible places where all those parallel worlds can be. Okay, and if you do that, that's forcing them to be very close together. And a consequence of that is that the repulsive force between them is going to be very strong. Okay? And so essentially, as soon as you sort of let them go, they're going to repel each other. And that means that their momentum is going to be have a huge spread. So you might say that that's an intuitive way of understanding where Heisenberg's uncertainty principle comes from too. I don't know whether it's been reasonable to you.
The moment, you know, you've talked or we've talked and I've only asked you about explaining effects that we've already seen, but can you predict different effects that might occur because of this formulation? You know, how would we test it? What type of experiment could test this, you know, compared with standard quantum mechanics?
Yeah, so that's the $60 million question. In principle, our theory is not just quantum mechanics, because, for instance, we think that it's only in the limit that the number of worlds becomes infinitely large that you actually get back quantum mechanics, okay? So we think that the theory is much easier to understand if you think of it being a finite but very large number of worlds. And then that raises the possibility that there could actually be deviations from our theory and from quantum mechanics. So this is sort of a hard thing to think about, but what it means is that, yeah, we might be able to come up with an experimental test which could tell whether it really is our theory which underlies quantum mechanics or whether it doesn't work.
Now, I apologize in advance for this next question because it's very fanciful, but it's popped into my head, and that means that I have to ask you. You know, we're sort of talking about the forces between these worlds, and I'm sort of thinking in a kind of very science fiction way, could you imagine manipulating that or using it in a way that would allow you to communicate with the other worlds or kind of send a message or somehow indicate to them that there is another world here?
Yeah, okay. So in our theory as it stands, we have no reason to think that that would be a feature of it, okay? Because obviously actually signaling from one parallel world to another is something very different from standard quantum mechanics and would be a pretty startling thing. But if I take your question in the spirit of science fiction, as you said, then I think certainly in science fiction you can imagine that would be possible. I mean, if you start by saying, you know, let's imagine that this many interacting worlds approach is correct, then you have, you know, the whole reality is based on interacting parallel worlds, then yeah, I think it's certainly possible, you know, in this sort of speculative science fiction context, to say, well, what if the interaction between the parallel worlds is not exactly as Hall, Deccan, and Wiseman are postulating? What if it's got some other contribution in it that does allow worlds that are further away to interact in some way and possibly to communicate? So personally, I think it would be, yeah, it would be great for science fiction writers to pick up on this. But as I said at the beginning, it's not part of our, you know, what we're trying to show or what we expect from our theory at all. But in terms of science fiction type speculation, sure. Yeah.
Thank you to Howard Wiseman for explaining his new theory to Zia. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to the team's paper, news coverage of their work, and links to previous podcast interviews about the different, but always entertaining, many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. That includes one of our most popular interviews ever with Nobel laureate and FQXI member Frank Wilczek, speculating on ways to test for parallel worlds.
There's also an extended version of Wiseman's interview where he talks about even more quantum features that his theory can explain. Now, Brendan, remind me, what item is coming up next?
Surely you can work it out for yourself. We've only got two items left on the podcast, and we ran through all of them in the podcast menu. It's not as though you need a crystal ball to work out the future. We all have the ability to predict the future based on information in our environment. FQXI member Suzanne Still, an information and computer scientist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, has been investigating this feature called predictive inference, and it may extend down to the molecular level. Still has been chatting with reporter Karin Pikama about how this may lead us to redefine the difference between living and inanimate matter.
The future is inherently uncertain. While on holiday in Hawaii, I was caught out by an incredible rainstorm wearing nothing but a t-shirt, as 10 minutes earlier there had been no cloud on the horizon. Based on my experience of living in the UK, where I have lived for several years, clear blue skies generally mean that good weather has set in. I quickly learned on subsequent days never to set out without my umbrella, whatever the state of the sky. Suzanne Still, who incidentally works at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, together with Gavin Crooks of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, has been wondering whether our ability to make informed predictions about the future will not only teach us when to bring an umbrella, but might also help us to formulate an entirely new definition of life. For animals and plants, it might be fairly obvious that they are alive, but for smaller systems, it might not be so straightforward. One way in which living systems might differ from non-living systems could be that living systems are able to adapt based on a sense of their environment, while non-living systems can't. Predicting the future based on past experience is a process called predictive inference and is thought of as an act of intelligence. With the help of an FQXI grant, Still and Crooks are investigating whether predictive inference is key to distinguishing between living and non-living systems. In two separate Skype conversations, both with slightly challenging connections, I caught up with Still to discuss their proposal and the first results. Still started by setting out their mission with an example in which she speculates about how she would learn from her experiences compared with how a rock would learn from its experiences.
If I chisel down on the rock, the change of the state of the rock will not inform about my chiseling in the future. But if somebody chisels on me, it's a whole different story. You know, living things learn, adapt, and predict, and non-living things don't seem to do that as well. But how far can we push that down to the molecular scale? There is something interesting that happens when matter self-organizes. But the process of self-organization in biology leads to the effect that basically in living systems, the whole is more than just the sum of its parts. And how exactly that works is still not quite understood. So a large variety of examples have been studied carefully. And this has led to a collection of many different special cases, but with no clear understanding of an organizing principle underlying the really colorful variety of life, which is fascinating.
So Still and Crooks, with their proposal, are aiming to find that underlying principle. still goes on to talk about the two most popular candidate principles that underlie life.
There is the efficient use of energy, which may give organisms a competitive advantage. And there is the efficient use of information. Now, people have pointed out that for an organism, information about the future is of the greatest utility because it allows it to predict unknown situations. So you basically build some kind of representation or some kind of model from the experiences you've made or the data you have acquired, and you want that model to generalize to data you haven't seen yet. In other words, you want that model to be predictive.
This process, which is called predictive inference, lies at the heart of Still and Crook's proposal.
The core question is, how does predictive inference come to bear on the fundamental physical limits of energetic and information processing efficiency? So can we do better? Can we push things to the ultimate limits if we process information in such a way that we pull out predictive parts? And in particular, we want to focus on a trade-off between efficiency and speed. So efficiency is just one side of the coin, because processes can be made efficient when they're running very, very slowly. But biology can't afford to wait long times. Or in other words, if I could figure out with a very high accuracy that that tiger over there is going to eat me, but it would take me a very long time to figure that out, then that tiger over there would eat me. So I need to figure that out quickly, but I might not be able to figure it out to like the greatest precision of all in the time given.
So to avoid the risk of becoming dinner for the tiger, it is essential that we sometimes also act quickly, even if that means that we might be running away from something that is not a tiger and waste more energy than is strictly necessary. Still explains that there are two major principles that influence the response speed of an organism or system. The first is that there is a trade-off between thermodynamic efficiency and power, meaning that it is possible in some situations for an organism to achieve the maximum efficiency with minimal costs in terms of power, and in others, to maximize power with minimum thermodynamic efficiency.
There is large literature on this, that there's this trade-off between sort of like thermodynamic efficiency and power, which we're in the process of studying using a model system. And then there's also the question of just simply computational time. So like, is there a trade-off between efficiency and computational time it takes to perform the computation, and how does prediction play into this?
In previous work, Still and Crook have shown that the system's memory may help to improve efficient use of energy.
We have shown that there is a connection between the dissipation of energy far away from thermodynamic equilibrium and that part of a system's memory which is not informative about the future. This can be used to quantify the efficiency or the effectiveness with which a system performs predictive inference. This connection that we showed between the thermodynamic efficiency away from equilibrium and this non-predictive information sort of might hint in the direction that biomolecular machines, in order to achieve high thermodynamic efficiency, might have to do something that resembles predictive inference.
In their proposal, Still and Crooks are asking whether it is possible for systems that use their memory to predict what an environment is going to do can be more energy efficient without losing more time compared to systems that are unable to use their memory. Limiting the waste of energy, or so-called dissipation, might be an important tool for these smarter systems.
So it's very easy for me to convince you that an organism would make some kind of prediction so that it can use them to accomplish something and have some advantage over other organisms. But some current research in neuroscience shows that parts of an organism can do that too. So if you take parts of the brain and you study them, you can find that some neurons or some neuronal circuits also seem to be doing some kind of predictive inference. But then you can go further and ask, how small can I go and still find systems that implement predictive inference? Does the machinery of life do something that smart on every scale? So in our previous work, we've taken the view that there's a system which is embedded into a stochastic environment, and that the way in which the system reacts to its environment betrays how much intelligence is built into the system. And in this setup, we have shown that the non-predictive part of the system's memory is related to dissipation, and that then suggests that under certain conditions, systems that can predict their environment better might perhaps do better in terms of dissipation.
While none of their material from this grant is yet published, and their work is still very much in progress, there are already theoretical conclusions that can be derived from it. One such theoretical result has come about with the help of Arne Grimsmo, a PhD student at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. In a response to an article still published in 2012, he made an important suggestion which has since led to a fruitful collaboration.
He realized that this relation we have between non-predictive information and dissipation also holds in the quantum regime. And so him and I, we started working together, and we worked out a theory for optimal quantum predictive systems. We managed to quantify the predictive advantage that a quantum system can have. So we understand now how the quantum nature of predictive inference plays out. Under what conditions can we have a quantum advantage? And how large can it be maximally? So we know the fundamental physical limits of predictive processing in quantum systems. Because the same relationship that we found for classical systems also holds in quantum systems.
Which is to say that in the quantum world, non-predictive information is again linked with thermodynamic inefficiency or dissipation. This new realization allows still to quantify the predictive advantage of a quantum system. And there is more to come.
So the next thing that we are then going to work on is this issue of feedback. So what if system and environment, system and experiment are evolved together in time? What if there's like two systems that influence each other, drive each other, and feedback onto each other in an informational sense and in an energetic sense? And there's new work by others that's going to help us a lot. We're in the process of extending our work from the discrete time setting to the continuous time setting, because we're going to need that to attack this question of strongly correlated systems when there's feedback.
Still and Crook's work on this grant to date has already opened up a new theoretical framework for thinking about energy efficiency in small-scale systems, work that is essential for our need for increasingly advanced technology. For instance, to build ever faster computers, scientists need to work at incredibly small scales. At such small scales, energy inefficiency can cause systems to overheat and thus sets limits on the smallest size a system can be. But with their results, Still and Crooks are hoping to give researchers new tools to limit the waste of energy, potentially allowing them to create much smaller systems in the future. But Still says that, for her, this is not the most important aim of their proposal.
The more exciting thing, I think, would be this view, you know, like, about life. I don't want to go back to the old belief that living matter is, like, fundamentally different from non-living matter. But still, there's this mechanism of self-organization, and then once systems sort of, like, self-organize, and the whole becomes more than the parts, then on a macroscopic level, you can definitely tell apart living systems from non-living systems, just intuitively, right? And so really what we want to get at is, you know, in what sense are they different? And they must be different in an information processing sense, right? But I would find it fascinating to see whether small-scale components of living systems are doing something like predictive inference. Doing predictive inference is an act of intelligence. So they would basically, by means of just running their dynamics, they would be doing something incredibly intelligent. If it's true that the way in which living systems differ from non-living systems is by means of the efficiency with which they process information and thereby also energy, then it would give us a whole different way of defining what it means to be alive.
That was Suzanne Still speaking with reporter Corinne Pikema. And you can read more about the work and the role of quantum effects in speeding up the process of predictive inference in an article by Corinne on the website www.fqxi.org/community.
Now, from telling the difference between the living and the dead to telling the difference between two electrons. One of the foundations on which quantum theory is built is called the symmetrization postulate, which in turn is based on the assumption that electrons are identical and indistinguishable. Physicist Philip Goyle of the University at Albany has been thinking hard about the validity of the derivation of this postulate from this assumption, which doesn't quite add up when you look at it closely, as he explained to reporter Colin Stewart.
University of Albany, New York researcher Philip Goyle has recently been awarded a large FQXI grant to look into the origins of the symmetrization postulate, one of the cornerstones of quantum theory. He started by explaining to me its importance in terms of getting to grips with a helium atom.
If you open up a textbook of quantum theory, this is how you deal with the helium atom. You'd say, let's have two electrons in the atom, and for the sake of simplification, just neglect interaction between the electrons. Now, let me also neglect spin. Then how do we solve the helium atom? We write down a Hamiltonian for the two particles, which is just like the Hamiltonian of classical mechanics. So we just write, you know, P1 squared over 2m plus P2 squared over 2m, and then a potential term that takes into account the interaction between each electron and the nucleus. We plug that into the Schrödinger equation and we solve it. We find the energy eigenstates. One of these solutions will be that the two electrons can be both in the 1s state. The same thing would happen if you had 3 electrons or 4 electrons or 5 electrons. They could all occupy the 1s ground state. There's no orbital structure here whatsoever. There's no concept of valence electrons. So the possibility of accounting for the periodic table and the chemical properties of the elements is completely gone. So the symmetrization postulates are what gets you out of this mess.
How is the symmetrization postulate able to do that? What exactly is it positing?
So it's a symmetrization postulate that says if you have, say, 2 electrons, what you have to do is when you get the answer from your Schrödinger equation, you have to do this mathematical procedure called antisymmetrization. So you have to subtract from the answer you get the wave function with the 2 electrons swapped around. And when you do that for the 2 electrons in the 1s state, the wave function goes to 0. So that basically just kills that possibility that the 2 electrons can be in the same state. That's then the explanation, as it were, within formal quantum theory for the Pauli exclusion principle. So you can't have 2 electrons in the same 1s state. I mean, spinless electrons. And so this anti-symmetrization thing is absolutely critical. It's what saves you from all the possibility of all the electrons piling into the ground state.
Applying the postulate in this way means treating the electrons as identical and indistinguishable, that they don't have some kind of identity of their own. I asked whether there was any evidence for this.
Yes. I mean, I think that's an absolutely staggering thing that we can do. So the way to think about this is that imagine you have 2 electrons which are shot from electron guns, one shooting from the left, one shooting from the right, and the electrons then enter some collisional region and they either scatter off one way or they scatter off the other. So one electron goes up, one electron goes down. It could either be the electron from the left goes up and the electron from the right goes down, or the electron from the left goes down and the electron from the right goes up. So those are the two possibilities. And imagine that the electrons are identical to us, right, as far as we can tell, as far as any observer could tell through measurements. But in fact, one of them is Paul and one of them is Peter. From the fact that one of them is Paul and one of them is Peter, which means that they have that identity and maintain that identity through time, it follows that we can use ordinary probability theory to compute the probability that we'll find one electron scattering up and one scattering down. And if you carry out that computation, you find that you get an answer which is wrong. I mean, it conflicts with experiment. It's demonstrably false. It's an amazing thing. And so as a result of that, we can say that 2 electrons aren't just operationally identical, they're ontologically identical. They really are identical at the absolute, you know, level. There's no hidden individuality to them.
So we can show that electrons are identical and indistinguishable, and that fits in nicely with our ideas about chemistry. So where's the problem?
Let's say that we've established that the electrons are truly absolutely identical. So let's suppose we even accept that at a kind of philosophical level to say, okay, that's really how things are. Then the question is, Well, all right, how does it follow from that that the symmetrization postulate holds? How do we get that mathematical rule from the bare statement that electrons are ontologically identical and aren't distinguishable? How do you do that? And historically, Pauli and Schrödinger in 1926 both independently, more or less, postulated the symmetrization postulate. And it was just like much of the rest of the quantum formalism, it was a piece of mathematical guesswork. And it worked. In one stroke, it unified the Pauli exclusion principle, which was already then recognized as being necessary to describe the behavior of electrons in atoms, and the behavior of photons, of the black body radiation. But when Dirac postulated it in his original 1926 paper, he gives what he thinks is actually a logical argument that leads necessarily to the symmetrization postulate. In other words, he thought he'd actually derived this from some very fundamental idea. But it turned out very quickly, it was pointed out to him by others, that it's not true. So from the very beginning of the history of quantum theory, the symmetrization postulate was known to be on pretty shaky ground. No one really quite knew where it came from, but we know it works very well. So basically what's happened since then is that in the 60s and 70s and then all the way until the present, people have tried to say, can we derive the symmetrization postulate? Or to what extent is it derivable? I mean, is it something like a rule of thumb that happens to work for the time being? Or is it something really, really fundamental that it just has to be the case? It just really has to be the case within the framework of quantum theory, that there's no other possibility. And so really that's what my work primarily has been about, is to try to, first of all, derive the symmetrization postulate as cleanly as possible to try to make this a secure bridge between the statement that a bunch of particles are identical and indistinguishable and the symmetrization postulate itself. In other words, try to make a bridge that goes directly from the abstract idea of identicality to the symmetrization postulate, and then also to carefully critique and analyze the other arguments that have been made, which have been very influential in physics, to actually analyze those arguments and to understand if they're mistaken or whatever, where exactly is the problem.
How did you get into this line of research and how are you getting on?
When I first encountered it as an undergraduate, I just couldn't follow the argument. I just didn't believe it, frankly. It's one of the few places where I said I don't believe it rather than I just don't understand it, but I didn't know how to proceed. Over the last several years, what I've been doing is engaged in this project of trying to reconstruct quantum theory, which is meanings to try to find a set of compelling physical ideas from which it's possible to derive the mathematics of quantum theory in a systematic way, and thereby hopefully give us a better handle on what quantum theory is really telling us about nature, and also give us a much better handle on maybe how we can generalize or apply quantum theory beyond how it's used at present, and particularly how it can be better integrated with our understanding of space-time. But until about 2 years ago, the main focus was what's regarded as the core of the quantum formalism, so the von Neumann postulates. But a couple of years ago, I thought to myself, well, what about identical particles? I'd always find them very mysterious and never really found anything that I read to be really clear and really compelling. And I thought maybe the kind of clarity that I've achieved through reconstructing Feynman's rules of quantum theory might be applicable to that. Maybe I can get a handle on identical particles. And then I managed to derive the symmetrization postulate. And at that point, I just started writing a paper on it. I thought, okay, I mean, this is a nice paper, fine. And it was only while I was actually researching the references that I realized, oh my God, there's actually a lot of effort trying to derive the symmetrization postulate from other points of view. That's when I realized that this is actually even bigger than I thought. This is actually a very, very interesting topic.
Thank you to Philip Goyle for talking about his research with Colin Stewart. You can learn more about Goyle's work, including its implications for the existence of proposed but as yet undiscovered new particles, in an article by Colin on the website, www.fqxi.org/community. So what do you think, Brendan? Could you tell the difference between two electrons?
Oh, definitely. Definitely not. But perhaps I'm not the best judge, Zia. I often get the two of us mixed up.
Well, it's easily done. We are a lot alike.
Yes, and the infinite copies of our parallel selves don't help either. And now the forces between them are causing us to deviate towards the end of this edition. Thank you to Howard Wiseman, Suzanne Still, Karin Pikema, Philip Goyle, and Colin Stewart.
As always, you can contact us at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter at FQXI.
To play us out, here's a song released by the Rosetta team in November, which the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko is singing into space. This song is made up of oscillations in the magnetic field in the comet's environment. It is being sung at 40 to 50 millihertz, far below human hearing, which typically picks up sound above 20 hertz. To make the music audible to the human ear, the frequencies were raised.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
You know, that song does sound a bit like something your band Mink Hollow might play.
Well, you're the one that didn't believe I really visited the comet.